book, English O'Clock. Let's go and get 2019 together.
¿Cuál es el origen de la palabra
robot?
¿De qué lengua viene? Pues viene del checo robota o algo así, que significa
forced labor.
Trabajos forzados. Eso suena a robots esclavos, qué buen rollo, ¿verdad?
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. That's right, Vaughan Radio, that's what you are listening to. Now, on previous programs, I know that this is a new year and tabula rasa, right? We're starting with a clean slate, slate pizarra, a clean slate. But I was in the middle of the story of Cortés and how, well, this encounter or un desencuentro, right? This non-meeting of the minds between the people of the Americas and the Europeans, how it all came about. It started badly. And on previous programs, I've been talking about Cortés, his life, his time in Cuba, his arrival first in Yucatan, the founding of the city of Veracruz, how he made his way into Tenochtitlan, right, what is today Mexico City, how he found allies pretty much wherever he went, strong allies, the Tlaxcalans. The Tlaxcalans who are going to be absolutely instrumental in the next phase. But we'll be talking about that in a minute. When everybody is shouting out, Viva Tlaxcala, Viva Castilla. Tlaxcala y Castilla, right? One and the other, two great peoples united in this common project of eliminating the Aztec Empire. And then, of course, later on, what happens to the Tlaxcalans? Well, okay. In any case, we are, the course of the narration went from his arrival there, how Moctezuma inexplicably allowed himself to be taken captive, how he joined them, something that later he lived to regret, and in the end was killed by his own people. Well, Moctezuma, how it was necessary after the killing at the Great Temple, the complete bloodbath, it was going to be necessary for them to leave. There was absolutely no justification for that. The people were wearing golden ornaments, and they were wearing all kinds of jewelry and precious stones, jade, other things, pearls, undoubtedly. And the men there, the men in charge, Alvarado principally, let himself be completely taken away by greed. He fell victim to his own greed. He killed everybody there simply for the gold that they were wearing in a religious ceremony. They were dancing. There was absolutely no sign of violence, no indication whatsoever that they were going to betray these people. So, simply no justification at all for the killing. And after that massacre, well, inevitably, the Spaniards were going to have to leave. They fought to get out. The Noche Triste came out with the bottom line there was that they came out more dead than alive. However, the Tlaxcalan allies, even though that they had lost a a significant number of their own people. We're talking about minimum 4,000 people, 4,000 warriors, so that practically every family in Tlaxcala had lost somebody. We are going to see how the Tlaxcalans decide that this is their moment, that they are going to be responsible for this war. They are going to provide up to 200,000 of their own people and their allies against Tenochtitlan, against the Aztecs. And this is going to be decisive. I mean, the narrative we have talks about a handful of Europeans with superior technology. The truth is that this is much closer to a war between two sides of, between the Aztecs and their enemies, their local enemies, their indigenous enemies. Now, luckily for Cortes, he had all kinds of luck. Luckily for Cortes, different expeditions kept showing up at Veracruz. And so they were able to replenish their muskets, their firearms, their guns. They were able to restock on artillery, on cannon. They were able to get their numbers up significantly. At this time, they are looking for the right way to attack the city. They came in from the north, from Chapultepec, and there they demolished part of the aqueduct that was bringing water to the city of Tenochtitlan. Remember that the water from the lake itself was not potable. It was not drinkable. And so they were utterly dependent on this aqueduct. Demolished, unusable. Now they're sort of in trouble. One thing also not mentioned is that at this time, they had fallen victim to, presumably, smallpox, viruela. Or at least, this is what people presume. There are scholars who dispute this, but the normal story is that they had fallen victim to smallpox and that their numbers had diminished. Smallpox had decimated, or much worse, had practically obliterated the population of Tenochtitlan, which has been estimated at, well, as high as 800,000. Many people talk about 500,000. At least 300,000. Well, now it has been reduced to a fragment of that, to just a shadow of what it was. On an earlier program, I was talking about the time when Cortes had to leave Tenochtitlan and go as quickly as he possibly could to the coast because there was an expedition there under the charge of Pánfilo de Narváez, who was supposed, they were under orders to arrest Cortes and bring him back in chains to the island of Cuba to be judged by his arch enemy, his arch rival, Diego de Velázquez, not just the governor, now the adelantado in Cuba. So Narváez was there with his men, a large contingent of men, and there was an attack, a nighttime attack, and Cortes was able to defeat Narváez, knock out his eye, so that for the rest of his life the man was tuerto. He was one-eyed, and he surrendered. And evidently there was a Negro slave there, a black slave, an African, dancing around saying, "Oh, isn't this wonderful? Have the Romans ever made a battle like this, right? Not even the Romans capable of doing something like this. And they all called him a fine fellow, dancing and telling them what they wanted to hear. Right. The slaves who decided to survive often developed a facility for telling their masters what they wanted to hear, or for at the very least being entertaining. Well, this same slave, evidently, according to the chronicles at the time, he was the one who brought smallpox to the land. And suffering from it himself, he brought it to the New World. Obviously, it had been there for a while. It had been there before. They were familiar with it. Because there were no defenses. There were already people suffering from it, but it had never hit Tenochtitlan. And so now the city was significantly weakened. Now, as I mentioned on the last program, just toward the end of the last program, there were expeditions sent out to make life difficult for these conquerors. Quite often, they physically kidnapped, abducted members of Cortés' party, Europeans, in order to be sacrificed on the temple to the war god, Huitzilopochtli. The fact is that if they had fought in another way, right? If they had been dirtier in their fighting style, if they had fought to kill rather than simply to abduct, then history would have been radically different. I mentioned three different attempts on Cortés' life, and all three of them failed because the goal was to take him away intact and sacrifice him on the temple. And they just weren't able to do that. If the goal had simply been to kill him at a distance, well, they would have succeeded, and they would have learned the lesson that Cortés already knew, which is to when you remove the leader, it's like cutting off the head of a snake. The rest of the body is incapable of defending itself. Right? He had done this again and again. This was something the Spaniards first learned in the Canary Islands, but it worked, and it worked in the Caribbean. It worked in the Gulf of Mexico. It worked on the Spanish Main, which is what they call them, the mainland, right? At first, the Darien Peninsula, what is today Panama. It certainly worked for Cortés when he used Moctezuma, and it worked later on for Pizarro, right? With the Inca, when in Cajamarca, when he was able to isolate the Inca, nobody else reacted. There was no chain of command. And on my last program, I believe, I talked about the Battle of Otumba, when the Europeans and their Tlaxcalan allies were radically outnumbered. I mean, we're talking about 100-1. And Cortés evidently identified the person in charge, went directly to him, killed him, had one of his men, ordered one of his men to pick up his standard, his battle standard, right, estandarte, the banner that he was flying, and the enemy host, right, hueste, the host, simply dissolved, broke up, went their way, inexplicably, absolutely inexplicable. Well, evidently the Aztecs did not learn their lesson, which would have been to take out Cortés. Well, they didn't. They tried three times to physically remove him from his guard, but that didn't work. Now, the fourth attempt on Cortez's life came from one of his own countrymen. As you remember, this rivalry, this enmity, the animosity between Diego de Velázquez and Cortés went way, way back to the beginning. And Diego de Velázquez, governor of Cuba, had lost many of his best men over to Cortés. Cortés told them there was a lot of gold. And, well, there was a lot of gold. Cortés had no intention of giving any to it, to them. But this was what he did. Convinced them to join his side. As I say, he was charismatic. He could charm the birds out of the trees. This is a frase hecha in English. He can charm the birds out of the trees. Well, Velázquez sent a man named Biafana, who began to conspire with other people to kill Cortés directly while he was at dinner with other captains. Now, the plot was revealed, and Cortés found out. In addition to which, evidently when they were searching Biafana, they found that he had on his person a piece of paper with all the names of his fellow conspirators written down. Now, Cortés probably wisely decided to punish Viafana alone and did so in an exemplary way, right, by hanging him, right, ahorcarle, to hang him by the neck from the window of his apartment. But of course, Cortés always had that tendency toward paranoia. But again, it isn't paranoia if they're really trying to kill you. So, in the middle of this, they were, by the way, in the city of Texcoco, or what was left of the city of Texcoco, with a clear view of Tenochtitlan. Texcoco on the shore of the lake. And Texcoco built out into the water. The enemy had destroyed part of the dike, el dique, part of the dike that separated two of the lakes, one of the lakes at a much higher elevation. And so that water began to flood the lake, right? Inundar, anegar, to flood. And and so the city, well, people were almost drowned. A lot of munition was lost. A lot of their gunpowder was lost. All of it became wet and unusable. Cortés immediately sent people out to find a replacement, right? The components of gunpowder, well, charcoal, saltpeter, but the sulfur, the sulfur had to come from the volcano. Popocatépetl, there was a deposit of sulfur up there that was used to replace the gunpowder that had been lost in the flood. Now, back in Tlaxcala, Martin López, a man who knew how to build ships, So, a shipwright. Yeah, somebody who knows how to do something, fabricante, no, right, W-R-I-T-E, right. So a shipwright, Wainwright, or W-R-I-G-H-T as well. It used to be the participle of work, wrought, but then a right was somebody who worked in this. So, we have all kinds of last names in English with right at the end of it. Boatwright, shipwright, Wainwright, all kinds of things like this. In any case, López was a shipwright and had been responsible for finding the trees. When we use trees as raw material, when we want the wood from the trees, we call that timber in English. T-I-M-B-E-R, timber. So he was responsible for cutting down the timber, talar esos árboles, pine trees, and then curing that timber, making it usable, and then bringing it all the way, 150 kilometers, from Tlaxcala and the mountains around Tlaxcala in order to build ships, large ships that could be used on the water for a naval attack on Tenochtitlan. The kind of ship that they were building, the brigantine, It was big. It was, you know, it's practically like, brigantines are practically like, I don't know, un almacén flotante. It's big and, it doesn't go very fast. It's very useful in this kind of military action. So yes. 8,000 of the Tlaxcalans bringing down that wood on their backs, because that is how they transported things. Remember that there were no animals that they could use, and as such, no real, and they did not have the technology of the wheel. So yes, everything transported on people's backs, including other people. Remember that. On an earlier program, I talked about people who had been captured on the coast, brought all the way back to the city of Tenochtitlan from the coast on people's backs, tied up in a net, like an animal, tied up in a net and carried on the backs of these people. Now, 8,000 of them, 2,000 more, with provisions. Many of the ships of the newcomers who had arrived in Veracruz, many of those ships were, dismantled, right? Taken apart and used for, stripped, right? Como en desguace, stripped for their, for the things that they, you know, masts and other things that could be useful in these brigantines. So yes, another 2,000 with these provisions and 8,000 as an escort. Now, another 2,000 from other allies. Allies on the coast, the Totonacs, and you can imagine the number of people, the sheer number of people there. They planned a ceremony. Remember that at that moment in Spain as well, all important. Religious festivities, all demonstrations of Imperium, everything was, everything involved a procession. And, the important people giving precedence in the processions, but, long processions. And this was brought to the New World under the, viceregal, New Spain, under the viceroyalty, that we're going to be, ceremony after ceremony in Mexico City and the other major cities in Mexico, the colonial cities there, religious festivals with processions, with ceremonies, with displays, with everything made public. Well, it begins now. Evidently, Cortés ordered a sort of parade that lasted 6 hours with all of these people marching through the city, marching through Texcoco, and everyone shouting, Tlaxcala, viva Tlaxcala, viva Castilla. Everybody shouting it, brothers in arms. Okay, I have to take a break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
La niñez es el momento en que hacemos preguntas incómodas. También es el momento perfecto para aprender inglés. Si no quieres que tus hijos se hagan mayores en saber inglés, olvídate de los viejos métodos que utilizaron contigo. Descubre Vaughan Junior, un método que despierta sus ganas de aprender y su curiosidad por el inglés. Aprenden de forma natural y divertida. Llámanos ahora al 91-133-5832.
El pueblo angloparlante de Vaughan gana decisión y seguridad en 6 días de inmersión en inglés. Disfruta de un entorno privilegiado y mejora, por fin, tu agilidad oral y comprensión auditiva. Piensa, habla, vive en inglés. Llámanos al 91-133-5833.
¿Por qué aguacate en inglés se dice
avocado?
¿Cuál es su origen? ¿Tiene algo que ver con los abogados? Espera 2 minutitos y sabrás la respuesta.
El vino recibe su crianza enriqueciéndose y perfeccionándose con el aporte del roble y de los años, como nuestros profesores. Los aromas sosegados del lugar, donde permite desconectar y concentrarse de una cata de 5 días muy intensos, donde disfrutará de los mejores caldos lingüísticos, concentrando un año de clases en las mejores barricas exclusivas, pero al alcance de todos. La mejor elaboración, análisis y cata de uno de los programas con más solera. Programa residencial de 5 días, donde su paladar disfrutará de la intensidad del idioma. 91-133-5833. Con los mejores profesores en las mejores estancias. 91-133-5833.
Hello, my name is Rafa and I am from Vaughan Town.
I am Julia and I'm from Vaughan Town.
My name is Fran and I am from Vaughan Town too.
And me,
and me,
and me.
La población de Vaughan Town no para de crecer, porque cada vez son más las personas que deciden mejorar su nivel de inglés viviendo una experiencia única de inmersión en el idioma. 6 días de convivencia en inglés que equivalen a 500 horas de clase. Reserva ya tu plaza y únete a los miles de habitantes de Vaughan Town que ya han alcanzado un excelente nivel de inglés. Llama ahora al 91-133-5833 o entra en grupovaughan.com. Y la próxima vez que te pregunten por tu inglés, podrás decir I am from Vaughan Town. ¿Por qué aguacate en inglés se dice
avocado?
¿Cuál es su origen? ¿Tiene algo que ver con los abogados? Pues no, no tiene nada que ver con los abogados. En realidad,
avocado,
al igual que aguacate, viene de la palabra azteca aguacalt o algo así, que significa testículo. ¡Bum! ¿Será por la forma o es que son afrodisíacos?
¿Qué?
Curso intensivo para el First Exam, el programa de Vaughan para superar el examen oficial de Cambridge y obtener el First Certificate, B2. Para más información, grupovaughan.com.
¿No quieres aprender inglés? ¿No quieres conocer expresiones y vocabulario? Ah, entonces no nos busques, porque con nuestros trimestrales mejorarás tu agilidad oral y nivel auditivo y reforzarás la gramática. En grupos reducidos y mediante el método Vaughan, aprenderás inglés. Así que no nos llames al 91-133-5833, 91-133-5833, ni nos visites en grupovaughan.com.
Sigue este programa a través de la aplicación de Vaughan Radio, FM, TDT Radio Nacional, Internet, red de emisoras repetidoras de la señal radio TDT y en los podcasts.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughan Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about the preparations for the big attack on Tenochtitlan, and how there was, in preparation for this attack, an enormous ceremony, and the importance of ceremony, the sheer importance of ceremony for these people at this time, you know, the late Renaissance, Baroque era. This was going to be the most important aspect of public power, ceremony, processions. 6 hours with the Indian allies shouting, Viva Tlaxcala, Viva Castilla. Now, Martin López, the shipwright, put his ships together. They assembled the brigantines once they were available, once they were there. But of course, the canoes never stopped. The canoes kept attacking. There were still, this was a way of tiring the enemy, a sort of war of attrition there. And whenever they could, they tried to set fire to these ships, burn down the El Astillero, right, the shipyard itself. Now, in exchange, Cortes set fire to enormous fields of agricultural produce destined for Tenochtitlan, right? They could see their fields burning. They could see the corn going up in flames. And especially land that he knew belonged to the priests there at the temple. Finally, in the last weeks of April, the brigantines were launched onto the water. There was a canal specifically excavated, specifically dredged, the word English, dragar, to dredge. Now, there was a canal that had been dredged for that purpose. Very broad and deep enough. These brigantines began to float out into the lake. And you can imagine, the sooner the better. Once everything was ready, 13 brigantines are going to be the greatest importance. You know, the entire battle plan, the entire strategy, Gira, right? hinges. A hinge, bisagra, no? Gothne. A hinge. To hinge. Gira sobre ello. Everything hinges on the brigantines, the ships that are going to attack the city. So, there are, let's say, 9,000. No, I'm sorry. 900. 900 Europeans. 900 soldiers of Cortes. Remember that there were a large, large contingent that were fed up, that never wanted to even remotely experience anything like La Noche Triste again. And Cortes sent them on missions in the south. Some of them were allowed to go back, but a very, very few were allowed to go back to their families and their encomiendas on the island of Cuba. But not many. Cortes wanted these people where they could, where he could supervise them, but they refused to participate. So yes, 900 soldiers, of which 90 had horses. So 90 cavalry, about 100 of them equipped with either a musket or a crossbow, right? Ballesta. So yes, musketeers or ballesteros, crossbowmen, and then a further 700, let's say, as infantry, equipped with lances and swords, espadas. Now, that was a formidable army, but certainly not enough to attack the city. The Allies, initially, had provided 70,000, no fewer than 70,000 of their warriors. But in the course of the siege, especially when it looked like Cortes was going to win, the number of warriors from tribes, let's call them tribes, that wanted to defeat the Aztecs went up to 200,000. In other words, allowing for the population collapse due to the smallpox, right, viruela, that Tenochtitlan was suffering, you can imagine the defenders of the city were outnumbered, easily outnumbered by the attackers. Cortes had at his disposal three very large cannon and 15 smaller explosive devices, right? Smaller cannon, brass, right, of latón. Now, the sulfur from Popocatépetl and saltpeter and charcoal put together, that gave them powder, but not enough, so that they were going to have to be frugal in the shots fired. Each ship got a crew of 25. Each ship was able to have at least one cannon, either large or small, on its bow, proa, and, well, almost from the start, they understood that this was going to be a real advantage. I mean, at the beginning, when it was time for the war to begin, You can imagine the number of canoes, war canoes. They say it was like enjambre, right? A swarm, reducing the enemy to insects. Still, this metaphor, the idea that that there was too many of them to count, that the surface of the lake was black with these war canoes. However, the war canoes using paddles. Once the cannon began to fire, once the volleys, once the bombardment of, and the confusion as a result of that bombardment, once that began to happen, and the brigantines, of course, could overturn the canoes so that the canoes could not, if they began to collide with the canoes, there was nothing that could stand up to the brigantines. And evidently, although they had tried to set the shipyards on fire earlier, they did not try at this point to burn down the brigantines, at least not on the water. So yes, very few of the Aztec canoes evidently returned to the city from which they had emerged. If you remember, initially, the Tlaxcalans were not convinced by Cortes and his men. Cortes had actually taken a sort of a detour, had taken a long way around to walk through their territory in order to try and convince them. He had been told that they were enemies, sworn enemies of the Aztecs. And so he wanted to convince them to become his ally. But they were not, at least initially, they were not convinced. There were men among them who believed that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. However, the war chief, the person in charge, Tecotencatl was opposed. I said, and what if these beings are supernatural? And he said, well, if we try to kill them and they die, then they are not supernatural. If we try to kill them and we can't, then there will be time to propitiate them and to ask for their indulgence and forgiveness. And very soon he could see that they were mortal, that it was easy to kill a Spaniard, and that there was nothing really special about these people, these Europeans. Xicotencatl was adamant, at least at first, and had to be convinced, you know, after the Spaniards did very, very well in battle. He was convinced that they could be allies and work together. Now, at this point, for some reason, he is dissuaded from that. He decides that this is wrong. He decides to go back. So he abandons this battle and tries to go home. Cortes sent a posse, a group of people to catch him. And the orders, of course, were to pursue, to overtake, and to matarle en caliente, right? I'd kill him on the spot. And this they did. So yes, his potential enemy, his worst enemy among the Tlaxcalans was now dead. The other Tlaxcalans had been much more enthusiastic about the Europeans. And of course, they had been as good as their word. There were, obviously, you can imagine, up to 200,000 of them working for this common project, the elimination of the Aztecs. Now, the Mexicans had suffered, the Mexicans being the Aztecs. The evidently Aztec is not the correct word to use when speaking about them. They would have called themselves Mexica. Aztec evidently was another people that dominated them, had dominated them in their prehistory. They had come from the north. These people had come into central Mexico from the north, from Aztlan, and at one point run into another group called the Aztecs, who had evidently dominated them, enslaved them, something like this. They had escaped, and they didn't really call themselves Aztecs until much later. In any case, Mexica, that was their name for themselves. But yes, these people defending the city, Moctezuma's successor had died of smallpox. And this pestilence was, again, in large part responsible for the confusion among the defenders and the demographic collapse of the defenders. Now, one of Moctezuma's sons-in-law, a man named Guatemotzin, he was only 23 years old at this time. However, he was considered well-trained, and everybody appreciated the energy, the spirit, the enthusiasm that his youth gave to him. Whenever the Spaniards attacked, they were always led on by him. I mean, he was very much visible among the defenders of the city, and quite familiar with different tactics, as well as Cortés's strategy, which of course merely consisted of a naval engagement. Alvarado, the one responsible for the massacre, right? The massacre at the temple. Alvarado, the one who had made this enormous jump on horseback across a canal during the Noche Triste. If you go to Mexico City today, they will show you where it is supposed to have happened. And evidently, well, he didn't do the jumping. It was the horse that did the jumping. And evidently, he lost the horse in that jump. But, Alvarado, with 200 European soldiers and 20,000 Tlaxcalans, in other words, 100 Tlaxcalan for every European, two cannon, were sent to the west of the city, to Tacuba. And Sandoval sent to Coyoacán in the south. Okay, combining with all of them, they attacked the city from three directions and took it. The fortress of Sholok, very, very close to the capital. Sholok fell to this combined attack by land and lake. And so that became a new base of operations. Sholok, the fortress, on the causeways, right, the roads over the lake, that became the base of operations for the ultimate conquest. They began to assault the city from the causeways. Now, in this, well, there was a rivalry for glory. And yes, Sandoval, Alvarado, Cortés, all of them wanted to be first, which of course meant that there was no room for strategic thinking or, a combination of forces. And this was quite clear to the defenders. Guatemotzin was prepared for them. He knew exactly what he was doing. And yes, this is going to be the ultimate showdown, the ultimate battle. Okay, from a military point of view, everything looked good until this point. And if there had been a plan at this point, or if people had stuck to the plan, to adherir o atenerse a, right? If people had stuck to the plan, then things would have worked much better. But naturally, improvisation, chaos, thirst for glory, many people lost their lives in a stupid and needless way. The captains, the soldiers, all of them disobeyed orders. Se acata, pero no se cumple, right? Okay, every morning, as soon as the sun was up, right, at dawn, at daybreak, the Spaniards came out with thousands of their allies in order to fill the canals so that they could pass over them, that the lack of bridges would not be an impediment to progress. So fill the canals and knock down or demolish any building or structure made in their that might stop them. Now, this was very, very slow work. And many of the veterans wanted Cortés to do something more dramatic, something more dynamic, something more like himself, right? Of something more Cortés-like. And who were, of course, were worried that if any of the other groups attacking got there first, that they would be forgotten by history. In any case, they began to burn, they began to destroy, but Guamotin knew what happened. This was becoming famous, notorious, all over Mexico. which meant that on a daily basis, Cortes was receiving offers of allegiance from other tribes, tribes that had heard or believed that the Aztecs were practically gone, that they would never be able to reassert themselves, and that Cortes was going to be the future leader. Well, at the same time, the Aztecs were, of course, communicating, evidently by smoke signals, communicating with their allies in an effort to coordinate something. Now, Cortes finally gave the order for an attack, a simultaneous attack, a concerted attack by all forces on all sides, converging on the great square of the city as the common center. They had already been under this siege condition for 20 days. And although there had been skirmishing, there had been no real fighting. So yes, Cortes at this point gave the final order. All right. I've run out of time. Thank you for listening. And please listen to my next program.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio. Descubre nuestros cursos trimestrales, la mejor forma de interiorizar los conceptos clave del inglés, con los mejores profesores que te enseñarán paso a paso sus secretos. El inglés como a ti te gusta. Llámanos e infórmate sin compromiso al 91-133-5833.
Lo que más miedo le da al profesional español es hablar por teléfono en inglés. Por eso, Vaughan ha desarrollado sus clases telefónicas, en las que trabajarás tanto tu comprensión.